the recorder now. Thank you. Good morning, everyone. I am Kamala Rampersad da Silva, Chief Executive Officer of the Caribbean Corporate Governance Institute, and it is my pleasure to welcome you to today's session entitled Managing in the Perfect Storm, Governance Challenges in the Energy Sector. Today's session is a continuation of our discussion on leadership, which we began 2 weeks ago with Sophia Noel, as she tackled dealing with difficult boards. This was followed by a really engaging discussion last week with Richard Young, former Managing Director of Scotiabank. In fact, some of you may recall that it was during this session that you requested that we focus on sectors of the economy. And so, the CCGI today presents the first of those focused discussions as we welcome former Energy Minister Kevin Ramnarine to discuss what boards need to know to be able to overcome the challenges posed by the existential threat to the energy sector. Despite efforts to diversify, Trinidad and Tobago's economy remains highly dependent on the energy sector. In addition to the impact of COVID-19 pandemic, we have seen a number of plants in that sector close their doors. Much of the chaos is as a result of the fall in the price of oil caused by the battle for dominance between Saudi Arabia and Russia. And of course, the fall in demand brought on by the restrictions to manage the COVID-19 outbreak. What former Central Bank Deputy Governor Dr. Terence Farrell characterized for us as a perfect storm. So former Energy Minister Kevin Ramnarine is someone who keeps a keen eye on the changes in the sector. In today's discussion, when he joins us, he will highlight some of these challenges and discuss some of the strategies which we may need to adopt if we are to manage properly in this new environment. So many of you in present for today's session know that we have been continuing this discussion. In fact, we've been leading the discussion on governance on a weekly basis online. Because we, like every other business, recognize the need to ensure there's business continuity and move to the online environment. However, there are a few of you who are joining us for the first time today. So, in welcoming you, I want to share that the Caribbean Corporate Governance Institute is a nonprofit membership organization. And we welcome everyone who wishes to join in our purpose of improving corporate governance practices in the region. Furthermore, those of you who need to earn CPDs or PDUs as part of your ongoing certification, you may use these sessions to claim your points. In order to do so, you need to have been registered for the session, and then you may write to us to get a letter of verification that you were a registrant. Also, new to our sessions, you will be receiving a few questions via poll. This would happen while the session is occurring. In fact, Christy may offer some of those poll questions early at this moment. This is to allow us to get feedback from you, which we would sincerely appreciate, as this helps us in our quest for continual improvement. Also, I am very happy to announce that the Institute will be hosting its inaugural Governance Week using Zoom. So it will be an online week of conference and activities from Monday, June 29th to Friday, July 3rd, 2020. Some of you may know that this Governance Week was initially scheduled to be held at the Hyatt Regency. However, demonstrating the flexibility of many firms, we have moved to the virtual environment as well. And I promise that Governance Week will be exceptional and we will be offering an international experience for you. Each day, daily sessions will focus on different broad themes. On Monday, June 29th, our focus will be on the private sector, and the keynote address will be offered by Marlene Street Forrest, CEO, Managing Director of the Jamaica Stock Exchange. I am particularly excited to have Marlene as our keynote for this day, because some of you may know the Jamaican Stock Exchange really has been able to demonstrate an ability to be best in the world, coming from a region that is a developing country as well here in the Caribbean. So I'm extremely proud of what Marlene and her team have been able to achieve for us, and I am expecting that she will be able to share some valuable lessons about leadership and governance for us in that sector. On the second day, June 30th, our focus will be on state-owned enterprises. We begin the keynote for this day with a very special presenter who has experience administering a corporate governance code for state-owned enterprises. And this is Mr. Donald DePalm, who is from Curaçao. I am particularly pleased that we should be able to add to our discussion in managing state-owned organizations, whereby there are rules which applies to how persons may be elected to a board and how that board is managed, the diversity and composition of the board, which is not solely dependent on the political party in power. So I think the keynote address from Mr. Donald DePalm will be very insightful and would help in our dialogue in terms of how we improve governance of our state enterprises. On day three, Wednesday, July 1st, we move our focus to family-owned businesses. I'm also pleased to share that our keynote address for family-owned business is someone who is an expert in that area. Ms. Annette Rahal, many of you would know, has been delivering a number of training sessions on family-owned businesses, and she promises to be able to really focus on what are the governance issues that are important in order to preserve the family, even as we move to help ensure that these businesses are profitable. We note that family-owned businesses are in the vast majority, not just in Trinidad and Tobago and the region, but globally. Family-owned businesses are really the backbone of the economy of many countries. Therefore, ensuring their success and continuity is an important element to ensuring economic stability for all of us. We end the conference with day four, July 2nd, that's Thursday, when we focus on groups and subsidiary. This is an area that creates a lot of challenges for persons who are actually working in organizations that are multifaceted like that. So I'm very pleased that our keynote address for Thursday, July 2nd, will be provided by Professor Frank Kuhneman, who is currently in Holland. Professor Kuhneman is a senior attorney at law, a partner in his firm actually, and someone who is a corporate governance expert who advises his country on corporate governance practices. So along with private sector practices and state-owned organizations, he actually has tremendous experience in advising parent boards and subsidiary boards. So Professor Kuhneman will be delivering the keynote address, where he will identify what may be some specific challenges and strategies that persons working within the context of boards who are groups and subsidiaries, how they may be able to manage effectively. He shared with me that he more than likely would include as part of his session, Mr. James McFedran. Mr. McFedran is a senior advisor to McKinsey and a retired vice president of Scotiabank in Canada. Both persons will contribute significantly to the discussion on groups and subsidiaries. And of course, it's a governance week. So on Friday, there's continued activity, But what Friday would be is the start of the offerings of our modules for the Certificate in Corporate Governance program. So Friday begins with module one, and every Friday thereafter, we continue with our modules for persons who wish to be certified in our governance program. We already have finalized all facilitators, and you should be getting further detailed information with this, hopefully later today, as we continue to share on the information and what we have finalized for Governance Week. Usually at this point, I will refer to our speaker, but I don't.
Kevin is on. Kevin is on.
Okay, so Kevin, forgive me. We do have a few.
I'm thank right you here.
Okay, wonderful. Usually I don't have such long opening remarks, so it's a good thing that we had a lot to share this morning as well. I'm happy that you've been able to join us, Kevin.
It's called filibustering.
Okay.
Well, it's good to have you here, Kevin.
Thank you.
I have a few housekeeping announcements that I'd like to make, Kevin, mm-hmm. just before we hand over to you.
All right. I'll just take off the video again.
Yes, that's all right. Also, just to let participants know, you have just received the first of our poll questions. So we'd be very happy if you would provide some answers to that. It should just take you 2 seconds. So our housekeeping announcements before we hand over to the presentation and discussion with our former Energy Minister, Mr. Kevin Ramnarayan. We would like everyone to remain on mute during his presentation, which should last between 20 to 30 minutes. You will be invited to make contributions or ask questions when he is finished. There's an icon at the bottom of your screen to raise your hands when you want to get our moderator's attention. You will need to unmute yourself and then press the mute icon again as soon as you are done so as to minimize disruptive noises. You may also make comments or ask questions in the chat feature during the session, which may be read out afterwards. As always, we are very grateful for our technical support, which is provided by Christy Johnsler Crouch from SmartServe Limited. If you would like to get online support for Zoom meetings, feel free to contact Christy, who is improving her skills considerably. As you see, we are using the poll aspect of Zoom today for the first time. Please note too that our meetings are usually recorded. So too will this meeting be recorded, and it will be sent to you afterwards by Christy. She will also ensure that the recording is available on the CCGI website, so members may feel free to go on afterwards and connect and listen to the discussions. Just before we hand over to Kevin, however, I would like to ask our chairman, Mr. Nigel Romano, to make a few opening remarks before we go into Kevin's presentation. Nigel?
Thank you, Kamala. And Kevin, first let me thank you for joining us and for agreeing to share your perspective on the energy industry. It's interesting that a few months ago, everybody would have been saying that the energy sector was the sector that would be devastated. And then, of course, the COVID-19 hit. And I think we have many more sectors that have been very badly hurt by the pandemic. Tourism, entertainment, travel, etc. And of course, some of those are affecting the sector. So we welcome your perspective, and I look forward to enlightenment as I usually do when I interact with you. So thank you very much. You're on mute.
All right. Thank you, Nigel. Could I start now, Kamala, or do you have more housekeeping?
No. You go ahead.
All right. Okay. Thank you very much, Nigel, Kamala. Looking through the list of people here, I see some familiar names. So good afternoon to everybody who is here. Jason Ramsingh. Good afternoon, Jason. Well, first of all, you know, I'll start. It's a massive topic. Mm-hmm. And the question really is, where are we and where do we see the next couple of years as a country? And, you know, being in former government and having colleagues and so on who, you're hearing me, right? Okay.
Yes, we're hearing you fine, Kevin.
So I'll just start off with what happened in the world. But before I start off that, I think everybody would be aware that prior to COVID-19, Trinidad's economy was in a state of what Roger Hussein calls a depression and not a recession, in that we had had economic contraction in 2016, 2017, 2018. And while we do not have formal figures yet for 2019, all the indications are that for 2019, the economy also contracted in 2019. So let me just share my screen here. All right. You all seeing that?
Yes, we can see it.
Okay. So what was Trinidad and Tobago looking like prior to COVID-19? You all see that table, right? Yeah. I still don't trust Zoom totally. Yeah? Yes, you know, when you get older, the older you get is the less you trust technology, right? So this is the last 7 years, and you could see that in the first column, you have the year, second column, you have real GDP growth. In that 7 year period, this country's economy has only had growth in 1 year, which is year 2015. We've had four consecutive years of economic contraction. So in 2014, negative 0.9%, 2015, 1.8% growth, 2016, negative 6.3%, and so on. These figures are either from the Ministry of Finance or from the IMF. So the 2019 figure is the IMF figure, and the 2020 figure is the IMF figure. And everything before that is Ministry of Finance. You have to be very careful in Trinidad when you're quoting numbers. Some people aren't very careful. They're very loose with numbers, but I'm very careful with numbers. 2019, according to Standard & Poor's and Moody's, would be overall negative. Standard & Poor's had it as negative 0.2, and Moody's had it as negative 0.4. So the consensus is that 2019 was a contracting economy. And of course, 2020 is being affected significantly by COVID. Just to give you some idea of how COVID has affected this country, one of the things you have to admire about developed countries is how quickly they get data. So I was able to get some statistics on fuel consumption in Trinidad for the month of April. So in the month of April 2020, we've had a 50% reduction in super gasoline sales year on year. That's April versus April. April 2019 versus April 2020. We've had a 43% reduction in diesel sales, April 2019 compared to April 2020. And we've had a whopping 81% reduction in jet fuel sales in the month of April. So April 2020 is really the low point, or the month from hell, as far as COVID-19 is concerned. So the IMF says that Trinidad's economy will contract by negative 4.5% in 2020. This is seen to be, from my estimates and from my colleagues' estimates, persons at UWE and so on, this seems to be, that negative 4.5% seems to be a conservative number. Now, so I looked at the IMF database of all countries in the world and their real GDP growth for the period 2015 to 2020. I set the year 2015 to 100, making it the base year. And I looked at what would have been the overall economic contraction between 2015 and 2020 for all countries in the world. Trinidad and Tobago is the seventh worst performing economy in the world, if you look at it like that. The countries which are ahead of us include, of course, number one on the list was Venezuela. And it also includes Equatorial Guinea, a country which I've which I actually know. I've visited Equatorial Guinea and happen to know some folks there. Also on that list, Macau, which of course, you know, Macau is a Chinese dependency. Macau's economy is heavily weighted towards tourism. So COVID would have literally destroyed Macau's economy in 2020. Other countries on that list include Libya, which is in the throes of a civil war, and Yemen, which is fighting a war with Saudi Arabia. So we are seventh on the list. We've overall contracted by about 12-13% in the last 5 years. In fact, I was telling Kamla last night when we spoke, I said, do you realize that you are now 13% poorer than you were 5 years ago? Probably not you individually, but on a per capita basis, Trinidad is producing 13% less than it did in 2015. So it's been a pretty difficult period for Trinidad. It started in 2014, around the time I was in office when this started. Oil prices peaked in the middle of 2014, and it was $105-$106 a barrel, and all was well. And then prices started to fall, mainly because of the oversupply coming from the United States and the decision then by OPEC to not take action to intervene in the market. So it's been a very difficult last 6 years for the energy sector in Trinidad. It's gotten pretty bad, as everybody knows. In 2020, what we've seen is that the impact of low commodity prices for ammonia and methanol have collided with high natural gas prices and have rendered many of the plants at Point Lisas uneconomic. And we've seen what is now, I think, 4 closures for 2020. And prior to that, there were 3 closures. 2016, of course, Mittal. 2017, the M1 plant, MHTL M1 plant. 2019, Yara. And then coming into 2020, we had the Titan methanol plant, the M3 plant, and the Nutrien O2 plant, and so on. So 35% of Point Lisas is 7 plants. Point Lisas has 20 world-scale plants. And they are broken up into 10 ammonia plants, 7 methanol plants, 2 iron and steel plants, and 1 urea plant. So 7 of that, what I just described, they are currently either closed or idle. So that paints a pretty bleak picture of Trinidad and Tobago over the last couple of years. But people, people accuse you of being a prophet of doom, but one has to first define reality if one is going to make a plan or to chart a course to turn things around. So if you look at this table here, the third column speaks to revenue. And the year 2014 is the year that I call peak revenue. 58.4 billion Trinidad and Tobago dollars in revenue is our peak revenue. It's the highest revenue number that we've ever had. The year 2015 was slightly lower, 57.3. You could see that there. And then, of course, our low point in the last decade has been 2017, 36.2. Now, the 38.5 there you see for 2020 is the most recent number from the Minister of Finance. You would know that a couple months ago, he said that we are going to have a shortfall in revenue of $9.2 billion. At that point in time, I publicly said that I thought that every time the Minister of Finance gives an update on revenue, that figure increases. So I expect that if he was to give an update on that figure again in the near future, the figure would probably increase again. By my calculations, looking at the structure of government revenue, and the structure of government revenue is taxes on income and profits is our main source of revenue. Taxes on income and profits includes a lot of your energy taxation. Then we have taxes on goods and services in Trinidad. And taxes on goods and services are what I call the demand-driven or the consumption type taxes, and those would be taxes which are realized as people consume. So these would include things like motor vehicle tax, things like the VAT and so on. And of course, if aggregate demand in the economy is lower than expected, you get a hit there too. So the first major category, taxes on income and profits, is driven mainly by supplemental petroleum tax, petroleum profits tax, corporation tax, and so on. There is, of course, taxes too on property in Trinidad. And you might say, well, we don't pay property tax in Trinidad, so what are you talking about? Well, within taxes on property, we have royalties. Royalties from the energy sector are within taxes on property, and that too is going to take a hit. So when I looked at the granular side of government revenue, you look at tax, income from capital and so on. My estimate for government revenue for 2020 is somewhere in the region of about 31 billion Trinidad and Tobago dollars. So it means that, of course, our expenditure hasn't moved. Our expenditure stays at $53 billion. The minister said he's not revising expenditure. So if revenue is $31 billion and expenditure is $53 billion, it means our deficit for 2020 is about $22 billion Trinidad and Tobago dollars. A very significant, of course, probably the largest deficit in recent memory. So the issue is, what happens in 2021? Well, as some of you all may know, Section 16 of the Income Tax Act allows companies to carry losses forward. So they are allowed to carry losses forward as deferred tax assets. And they're allowed to use those deferred tax assets to reduce the taxable income and pay less tax. My view is that many companies in 2020 are going to suffer, especially in the energy sector, are going to suffer historic levels of losses, and they are going to be carrying losses forward. If you look into Heritage Petroleum's 2019 accounts, you would notice that it did not pay petroleum profits tax. PPT, which is the oil and gas sector equivalent of corporation tax. And the reason for that, again, is that they have a deferred tax asset that they have been utilizing. So the long and short of it, to get to the point, I see 2021 being the same as 2020 or worse because of the carry forward losses, companies utilizing the deferred tax assets, and because the price environment is going to stay pretty low, and the production environment from the energy sector is going to be not dramatically changed from 2020. So we are in for a difficult 2020. We've come out of a difficult period. 2018, 2019 has been no joy for anybody in the private sector. It's going to continue for a while. And perhaps later in the Q&A, I could tell you where I see the light at the end of the tunnel. I see the light at the end of the tunnel probably three years out, or probably even further than that. But Trinidad will rise again, but it's not going to happen in 2020 or 2021. Then you look at oil production. You see oil production has been in constant decline. We've had production fall by almost 30% in the last 5 years. We are at production levels last seen in the era of black and white westerns. We have natural gas production struggling, and that's a big issue. I was asking one of the CEOs at Point Lisas, who manages several plants. I'm asking him, what is your biggest worry as a citizen of Trinidad and Tobago? And he said his biggest worry is that we have now a lot of idle capital in the form of plants that are just there. Seven plants in Point Lisas are down. So that is capital which is simply not bringing value to the country and is depreciating while it is down. So gas production continues to struggle. Do we have a gas shortage at this point in time? Actually, we don't have a gas shortage. And the reason for that is that we have lower demand. So with seven plants long in Point Lisas, you have lower demand. So supply is lower, and supply at this point in time, I think it meets demand. So that is a sort of preamble to the entire thing. This graph simply shows what has happened, which we all know. The second quarter of 2020 is going to be forever remembered for many people as the quarter from hell. And that is because of COVID-19's unprecedented impact on the world economy. The world economy is going to contract by 3% overall in 2020. The last time that happened was during the Great Recession, 2008 into 2009. We know that the oil markets are oversupplied because people aren't driving, planes aren't flying as they used to. But we expect that things will begin to pick up in the second half of the year as demand returns, as lockdowns begin to roll back. That, of course, has had this incredible impact on price, and we've had the situation where we had negative prices in the month of April. I don't think we're going to go back to that negative price environment. I think the OPEC intervention in the market to cut 10 million barrels of production out of supply has stabilized the markets. This is the global oil industry, and this comes from the Petroleum Economist magazine. And this really gives you an idea of how people are hurting. According to Rystad Energy, which was quoted in the Petroleum Economist magazine, the exploration and production industry, which includes your BPs and your Shells and so on, they made $2.47 trillion in revenues globally in 2019. In 2020, that is going to fall to $1.47 trillion, which is a 40% decline in revenue. That's a huge decline in revenue. And in 2021, there's going to be a modest recovery. That 1.47 is going to increase to 1.79. But interestingly, when CEOs were surveyed by this consulting firm, Simon Kucher, again quoted in the Petroleum Economist magazine, the main findings were that companies are focused on cutting CapEx by up to 30% in the near term. And by companies, we mean BP, Shell, ExxonMobil, because ExxonMobil does have an impact on the Trinidad and Tobago economy now, because a lot of the services that they require in Guyana come out of Trinidad. And the CEOs who were surveyed said that it could take up to 3 years for the Brent price to get back to $60 a barrel, which is where it was in the pre-COVID world. And the new focus, and this is where this is linked to corporate governance, the new focus is going to be on operational efficiency and capital use rather than on growth. So I think our friends in the upstream sector would be focused on cutting costs, on becoming more lean, on doing more with less. We've heard that companies are already beginning to rationalize their management structures and so on. So cost management becomes very critical. And the focus, therefore, is on cost. What has happened, unfortunately, for Trinidad is that our ammonia and methanol plants at Point Lisas, and I think there's some people from Point Lisas here right now, over the last couple of years have moved from being, have become some of the higher cost producers in the world. So it costs Trinidad and Tobago on average about $175 to produce a ton of methanol. So I'll say that again, because that's not public information. So that is information that I got from my own research. It cost us about $175 to produce a ton of methanol in Trinidad. That compares to the United States, as the United States could be somewhere in the region of $100 per ton. So the scenario of 30 years ago, when we were pioneering methanol in Trinidad, has flipped. We are the high-cost producer, and the U.S. now is the low-cost producer. It is even lower in places like the Middle East and so on, in Saudi Arabia and so on. So the situation right now with methanol, I think the last time I checked methanol prices, they were about $150 a ton. So that means that many of your methanol plants in Point Lisas would be in trouble. And I mean, interestingly, I think 4 out of the 7 plants are down. So costs becomes very important. Managing costs in that sort of environment becomes very important. So this is simply where we see prices, the oil price going in the next couple of years. Just give me 1 minute, please. And a meeting. Yeah, this is where we see the Brent price going in the next couple of years. So the Brent price is expected to average $34 this year, and that's down from $64 last year. So that means that the government is not going to collect any supplemental petroleum tax from March 2020 going forward, because supplemental petroleum tax is only triggered when oil is above $50 a barrel. They see that scenario continuing into 2021 with the price averaging at $48 a barrel. At these prices, it is difficult to get anybody to invest in new drilling and exploration and so on in oil in Trinidad. And that is one of the reasons why we've seen production fall to levels last seen in the era of black and white westerns, as I used to say, because I went back and did that research too. This is a snapshot of natural gas prices. And I did this last year, but it's still relevant today. Trinidad and Tobago set its budget at $3 per MMBTU last year. Now, it's important to know what is this mysterious gas price in the budget. So the budget is predicated on oil price, and everybody knows about the oil price because everybody watches CNN. And everybody sees the oil price on CNN. It's one of the most popular commodities in the world, so people know what the oil price is. But the gas price is more mysterious for Trinidad. So the price that you see in the budget for natural gas is the wellhead price. It is the weighted average wellhead price. As Minister of Energy, I knew that. I wasn't sure if this government continued with that. And on the 10th of March, 2020, in a press conference, the Minister of Finance confirmed that it is the wellhead price. So the price that you see as the Henry Hub price on CNN and BBC is not the price that we are fetching at the wellhead in Trinidad. So we have rebased the price assumptions for the budget. It's no longer $3 per MMBTU. But the point I wanted to make is that long before COVID, natural gas prices globally were in free fall. And here's the evidence. In Asia, comparing September 2018 to September 2019, 51% decline, huge decline. In Europe, comparing the same time, the same 2 months, 47% decline. The USA, 23% decline. South America, 52% decline. So I made sure I got South America prices. That was hard to get. But I didn't want somebody criticizing me and saying I leave out South America, right? So gas prices were in decline well before COVID. COVID simply made a bad situation for the energy sector in Trinidad worse. So when COVID happened, we started to get the Chinese declaring force majeure on LNG cargoes. We started to get prices in Asia going down to about 250 per MMBTU in Japan, which is unheard of. Right, so it simply made a bad situation worse. And I'll just touch a bit on what really drives this economy. And we all know it's the energy sector, and we all know we have to diversify, and we've been talking about diversification since I was in primary school in the 1970s, and we have not really diversified the economy. I am happy to see that we have a strong financial sector. One of the things that was a feature of the Great Depression of the 1930s, was the failure of the banking system in the United States. The banking system in the United States has not failed. Far from it, the banking system in the US appears to be strong. One of the features of the recession in Trinidad in the 1980s, and I'm saying this because I know we have an eminent banker here. One of the features of the recession of the 1980s in Trinidad, of course, was bank failure in Trinidad. And from that, you had FCB being born and so on. So we have seen our banking sector in the US and the banking sector in Trinidad hold up. So from that point of view, it's a different scenario from the 80s in Trinidad. Our banks are pretty strong compared to where we were in the 1980s. But this graph shows what really propels this economy. And it's the production of hydrocarbons. So the blue line is total hydrocarbons percentage change. So the y-axis is really growth or contraction, it's percentages. And the orange line is real GDP. And as I told a previous gathering, if I show this to a standard five child, they will probably tell you, okay, the two lines tend to follow each other, right? The two lines are generally following each other. So the more we produce oil and natural gas, it's the better it is for Trinidad. And the reality is that we've been in decline in both gas production and oil production for the last decade. We attained peak natural gas production in 2010, and that was 4.3 billion cubic feet of gas per day. That was the top of the mountain, right? And if you want to see what the mountain looks like, the mountain looks something like this. That big blue tsunami to your right has a peak, and the top of Everest is there, and that is the year 2010. And that is the year that we summited Mount Everest and we surveyed the world, and we were, Trinidad and Tobago was the master of the Caribbean, and Time magazine, different magazine wrote glowing stories and so on about Trinidad's energy model and so on. And then all good things, of course, come to an end. We attained peak oil production in 1977, at the height of what was the oil boom of the 70s and so on. So our economy really is, to this day, really driven by natural gas. And natural gas production and GDP are correlated by, for the last 20 years, the correlation is 0.98. So the horse that really pulls this wagon is natural gas production. So how do we produce more natural gas? How do we produce more oil? Well, we need to drill. The last time I checked, we need to drill. And this is what's happening with offshore rig days, offshore drilling activity. It's really been in decline, and this is by month. And this is a bit painful to draw this graph because the ministry publishes a lot of its data in PDF. So you have to like manually go and pull this out. The blue in this graph is drilling activity from BP, Shell, EOG, BHP, and De Novo. And the red is Trinma, which is Petrotrin. And there's a story behind why I stripped out Trinma only. Well, that's offshore. This is just offshore activity. So offshore activity has come really right down. If you look to the extreme right of the graph, it's March 2020, and we really have very little activity. There's one rig working offshore right now, which is the Ralph Kaufman rig working for EOG. Drilling activity should pick up in the second half of the year, but it's nowhere near to where we were 5 years ago. This is land-based drilling activity. Same story. Activity levels on land have almost come to a halt in terms of drilling. And again, the red in this graph here is Petrotrin, Heritage, whatever you want to call it. And the reason I put that in separately is to demonstrate the extent to which, whether you call it Heritage or Petrotrin, has really receded from the economy. And that has had, and of course, there's no refinery. And that has had a really significant impact on the economy in South Trinidad. Because Petrotrin and or Heritage or Trinma, whatever you want to call them, they really have a lot of spin-off benefits for people living in South Trinidad. So I think the economic depression really is pretty pretty much taking its toll in South Trinidad. So where do we go from here? And the natural question is, you know, what would you do if you had the opportunity to do something? Well, I think that I see people writing all sorts of nice things in the papers, and I see a lot of people like myself have a lot of graphs. And just giving you the benefit of my experience of sitting to the right hand, to the right hand of Larry Hawaii for 3 years, running a country like Trinidad, of course, requires money. And the Minister of Finance, on a monthly basis, he has his first headache every month is to make sure that there's enough money to pay public servants. So the Minister of Finance, the first thing that he is very angsty about is that he has to get about $1.5 billion, I estimate, every month to pay public servants. And that includes your people in police service, includes your army, it includes your daily paid people and so on. Pretty large bill. So we need money to run this country. And I just pointed out to you that we only will be earning about $31 billion. And our expenditure is $53 billion. People have asked whether we could cut that expenditure anymore. In my opinion, that is going to be pretty difficult to do because it's already a bit painful at $53 billion. So where is this money going to come from in the short term? Because the first thing any prime minister would ask any minister of finance and any minister of energy is, tell us where the money coming from. Well, the country is going to we have some options. And I think we are still in a much better position than our friends in CARICOM, because their economies have been completely wiped out by COVID. I saw a letter from Nigel Clark, Dr. Nigel Clark is the Minister of Finance in Jamaica, to the IMF. And in the letter, he said that the tourist asset of Jamaica, the tourist plant, is at 0% utilization. It means that there are no tourists in the hotels in Montego Bay. There are no tourists on the beaches of Jamaica. It's really bad in those countries. We still have stuff that we produce. We're still producing some ammonia, some methanol. We're still selling oil, crude oil. So it's not that bad here in Trinidad. But what are the options for cash? One option, of course, is the HSF, which the minister has tapped into. The other option, of course, is to raise capital. Either on the bond, it's a raise financing on the bond market or to borrow money. The third option, which is one which I think Mala Dukaran had initially flagged, is the IMF's emergency funding facilities. They have, the names don't come to mind, there are a couple of them, but we saw last week in the papers where the Bahamas had gotten their money from the IMF and the interest rates are really low. And these loans are for emergency funding for COVID. They don't come with IMF program attached to them. So it's not an IMF conditionality. They're not IMF conditionalities attached. And then the fourth thing, which is just something I put out there, but it's not something that I would recommend at this point in time, is to sell assets to get cash. And the reason I wouldn't recommend it is that in this low price environment, you're really going to be selling stuff at fire sale prices. So we still have some assets that, but I think if you put them for sale now, you're probably going to get a pretty, you wouldn't get the true value of it. So the immediate task for the country is really cash management, and to keep the economy ticking along. And in the more medium term, we really have to address the issue of production of oil and gas. And I say medium term because you're not going to turn those curves upward for 2 to 3 years. There is, of course, a deep water exploration taking place, which may well mature with production in 2026. And if that happens, that's fantastic for Trinidad. And there are some other projects in the oil industry that warrant mention that, you know, should keep our natural gas production ticking along. But the real big win for Trinidad would be the deep water in 2026. So in the short term, I would say cash management, very important to keep salaries being paid to pay for services and so on. And in the medium term, increasing oil production, increasing gas production, and focusing on diversifying this economy. I would end by saying there is a significant opportunity for this country that is presented by Guyana and Suriname, which is as those countries develop their deep water oil production, they are going to need a lot of services. Some of those services are already coming out, as I mentioned, out of Trinidad, but perhaps we should be looking at this in a more strategic way to position this country in a strategic way to benefit from what is happening in that part of the world. Because as you know, Guyana and Suriname don't have any deep water facilities, harbors, because of their geography and the very large rivers that silt up their coastlines. We do, and God has blessed us with the Gulf of Paria. And I keep telling people, our greatest asset is not oil and gas, it is the Gulf of Paria, right? It is almost like a natural lake in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean that we need to be making more use of. So I'll end there, but I'll say from a corporate governance point of view, cost management in this environment becomes very critical. And that's where boards have to exercise their oversight over management. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Kelvin. So basically what you're saying, and I will let the other participants jump in, is that we're basically in survival mode. We need to navigate this very serious dip, which has been exacerbated by the COVID crisis, and conserve our resources while we continue to produce. But from what you're saying, one of the factors that we have to look at is controlling the cost of production and ensuring that whatever cash we have is utilized very, very prudently. For me, yeah, as a banker, one of the things we'll need to be doing is having a conversation with our bankers to convince them that it makes sense to support the various enterprises through this difficult time. Again, that's a whole different conversation. But do you have any, based on your experience, do you have any specific words of advice, specific words of wisdom that these companies should be focused on in the immediate, in the short term, to achieve that conservation of cash or access to credit lines or increased production?
Well, in a loss-making environment, which is what I believe most of them have been in, and I think some of the ammonia plants were losing money before COVID. Mm-hmm. Because remember, Yara plant shut down in December last year. Mm-hmm. And I remember meeting one CEO who runs an ammonia plant, and I asked him, I said, let's look at them and say, above water, below water, breathing with a straw. He said, breathing with a straw, right? So that was like October last year. So those ammonia plants have been really going through some difficult times, and then the methanol price fell. Many of them, fortunately, the larger ones have parent companies, like the Nutrients and so on, and they are part of larger multinational companies. And I think they will be able to access credit lines because of their, the size and the credit ratings of their parents and so on. So, I mean, my understanding is that is what has been happening, that they've been surviving by getting some of them loans from the parent, which they may have to pay back in years to come. Some companies have also taken the decision to do maintenance while the plants are, while the prices are low. So those are some of the survival strategies. And of course, one survival strategy, Nigel, is to idle your plant and wait for the storm to pass, which is what you know, six of the plants in Point Lisas have done. But the question is, given that we are the highest cost producer in the world for ammonia, or among the highest cost producer, it means that as prices recover, we will be the last to start back up. We'll be the first to shut down. The highest price producer is the first to shut down and the last to start back up. So the question is, when will those plants at Point Lisas begin to restart? And the other issue, which I didn't mention, is the future of the NGC, which warrants an entire other Zoom presentation. NGC's business has shrunk by 25% in the last 5 years. In 2015, NGC was selling 1.6 billion cubic feet of gas per day. NGC is now selling 1.2 billion cubic feet of gas per day. So I was telling somebody last night, I like to use, you know, local examples. I say, if I have a rum shop and I'm selling white oak, and all of a sudden white oak sales fall by 25%, I would be concerned as the owner of the rum shop. So I'm sure Conrad is concerned that NGC is selling 25% less than it did, you know, 5 years ago. And the reason for that is that there will be no NGC without the customers of the NGC. The NGC's customers are disappearing one by one. And we really now have to question whether the business model of the NGC, which was set up in 1975 in a totally different world. It was set up by Errol Mahabir and Dr. Eric Williams back in 75, whether that business model is still relevant today. And that has been one of the most, one of the most interesting discussions in the energy sector for the last couple of years. But I remember some years ago, Robert Riley saying in a speech that he gave to the Chamber of Commerce that the time had come to consider allowing the upstreamers and the downstreamers to meet in a more perfect market and remove the middleman. The Poten and Partners Gas Master Plan, which happened under my tenure, but I allowed Poten and Partners the intellectual freedom to write the Gas Master Plan. They came up with the recommendation to preserve the NGC and to expand the NGC's footprint into Atlantic LNG. In that the upstreamers should sell to NGC and then sell the NGC sell on to Atlantic. Of course, that wasn't warmly received by the upstreamers, neither people in Atlantic. Then we've had Dr. Farrell come out. Is Dr. Farrell here by any chance?
Yes, here.
Okay. We had Dr. Farrell in his report last year, which I attended that presentation. And, you know, he sort of, again, put out the whole question of whether we should revisit the NGC model. I have been on record as saying I support the NGC model, and I am now on record as saying that it is now, I have shifted a bit, and I'm saying that it's probably time that we have a conversation about the relevance of the model going forward. Because the question is, do we want to, in the year 2030, look at Point Lisas and see Point Lisas operating fully and so on? Or do we want to see a rust belt? And, you know, a friend of mine was telling me the story of what he calls two roundabouts. You know, we have roundabouts in Trinidad. Mm-hmm. They don't have roundabouts in the US, right? Roundabouts are a creature of the United Kingdom, right? So we have roundabouts here. There's a roundabout called the BC roundabout. Anybody knows? I don't know if you all know what the BC roundabout is. The BC roundabout is the roundabout as you enter Point Lisas. Mm-hmm. That's by the KFC. And from the BC roundabout all the way down to the what I call the Coquille roundabout, in Coquille in San Fernando. For those of you all who know South, you take the Coquille roundabout to go Soong's Great Wall, right? Between those two roundabouts is really an industrial belt that stretches from Cuba and goes all the way to San Fernando, and includes Point Lisas, includes TCL, includes a lot of energy service companies along that belt. And that belt sustains a lot of employment, a lot of small locally owned mom and pop type family owned service companies are in that between those two roundabouts. So I think that I would like to see that industrial belt, and that also includes in that belt, that includes the refinery in that stretch there. I would like to see that really preserved. So I would like to see Point Lisas around in 10 years' time. And the question is, how do we achieve that? Mm-hmm. And the is it that, and I put all this in another group, is it that we, the government has to focus on getting a smaller slice of a growing pie, or on the other hand, a larger slice of a shrinking pie? Because right now it seems that we're going for the larger slice of the shrinking pie. And do we, is it that we have to, is it that the government has to give up something to keep Point Lisas and to keep our industrial base and so on going? So I'll just put that out, you know. But the role of the NGC, of course, is critical to that discussion. And it's a very interesting and sometimes heated discussion.
Yep. The question for me is that if the NGC ceases to add value, if that belt ceases to add value, then it will disappear. Us talking about it and hoping will not keep it alive. And therefore, how does it create value, and who does it create value for? Can Guyana and Suriname be saved out of the belt of the two roundabouts? I don't know.
Well, there's Iscot Dock. Mm-hmm. One of the most valuable assets that Mittal had is the marine infrastructure in Mittal. I don't know what the National Energy Corporation is doing with that. I don't know what Plebeco is doing, whoever is in charge of it, but it is a significant asset. When you fly over Trinidad, sometimes you see it from the air, and that could be used as a base for a sort of free zone on the along the lines of what happens in Dubai or the Jebel Ali port to service Guyana and Suriname. But these are simply my ideas, you know. So mm-hmm. I think that is how we have to think.
How we do.
Maritime services is a big job creator for places like Singapore and Dubai and so on. There's no reason why we can't do it in Trinidad. Again, as I said, the country's greatest asset is the Gulf of Paria, which is not going to go away anytime soon.
Mm-hmm. We have a question on the chat, Nigel.
Thank you.
It's from Glenn Goddard. He says, thank you for your presentation, Kevin. I am interested in your position on the fact that most oil and gas majors have announced transition to net zero carbon products. Customer and investor concerns are driving this. Trinidad and Tobago will get left out if we don't transition as well. So what is your position on that?
Well, that's a very, very, very serious issue, because BP, who is our largest player, they have a net zero position. I'm told Shell has a similar position. And the interesting thing, Glenn would know, that one of the largest single source emitters of carbon dioxide in Trinidad is Atlantic LNG, which is owned by, coincidentally, BP and Shell. So the question is, in BP and Shell's future, does Atlantic LNG with its big carbon footprint fit here? Are they willing to come in and make the investment to make Atlantic LNG a zero carbon facility, which is going to cost a lot of money? So that is one thing I'll put out there, that it's well known from people who know the data on CO2 in Trinidad that Atlantic is a major CO2 emitter. The other issue is power generation. And power generation is, Trinidad and Tobago has one of the highest per capita power consumption rates in the Latin American region. All of our power comes from natural gas, and our electricity in Trinidad at the residential level is between 4 to 6 US cents per kilowatt hour. It is the lowest in the Caribbean. It is only probably lower in Venezuela, which is not a good comparator. But in Guyana, people pay 26 US cents per kilowatt hour for electricity in their homes, right? The question is that subsidy, there is a subsidy on electricity in Trinidad. Who pays that subsidy? The National Gas Company. There is some gas tranche contractual presence for power in some contracts, but by and large, the NGC still has to subsidize the price of natural gas that we burn to get our electricity in Trinidad. That cannot continue for too long again. Mm-hmm. The accounts of the National Gas Company are due to be released in June in this month, and I'm awaiting to see how the TNTEC accounts receivable shows up on that. Because for many years, the NGC and the TNTEC have had this romance, this dysfunctional romance, to try to use a metaphor. But the NGC sells TNTEC natural gas. It's subsidized, but TNTEC still does not pay the NGC or does not pay the NGC on a timely basis. So what you find is that the NGC always carries a very large accounts receivable related to TNTEC. Of course, you know, auditors these days, Nigel might know the new, is it the IFRS standards?
Yes.
Right? The new IFRS standards frown on receivables that, you know, are of a certain age, and those receivables will be impaired. And once receivables are impaired, they move from your profit and loss statement into your P&L, right? So what is the point? The point is that the subsidization of electricity in Trinidad, Glenn, cannot continue forever. In fact, I think it may come to an end sooner than later because it is unsustainable. On top of that, TNTEC is having difficulty paying TGU. Now, TGU has a $600 million US dollar bond that they have to service because TGU was built with a loan of $760 million US dollars from the government of Trinidad and Tobago. And TGU has paid back $600 million of that $760 by, of course, raising a bond, and TGU has a bond to service. On the other hand, TGU has one customer, which is TNTEC. And that customer, of course, there are difficulties with TNTEC paying TGU. So all this is related to the fact that we have an unsustainable pricing structure for electricity in Trinidad. And I cannot see, it's going to be very difficult. I know right now, probably from a political point of view, and I have a friend who says that good economics is bad politics, and bad politics is good economics, right? It is going to be difficult to sustain that going forward. But I don't see that being tackled in 2020, simply because, I mean, the population already has so much on its plate, you know, but it is something which is unsustainable and which contributes to our CO2 emissions. Because energy is subsidized in Trinidad, of course, people are more prone to wastage. So those two things I would just throw out there. Glenn probably would be able to speak with more quality to the Atlantic LNG issue. I don't have the exact figures, but Atlantic is a major emitter of CO2. Mm-hmm. And I was told for them to cure that problem, it's going to require significant capital investment. And at the same time, their two major shareholders have pledged to net zero carbon emissions. So what does that mean for Trinidad going forward? I just threw it out there. I don't have the answer to that. Right? Yeah. So our two major upstream companies have gone in that direction. In fact, the president of BP has said, this is Bernard Looney, Bernard has said that one of his legacies is going to be that transition. That transition is going to happen under him. And of course, we know BP and Shell have put in a proposal for a solar farm for Trinidad. So whether you like it or not, the world and Trinidad is going to be dragged into that direction.
Any comments from any of our participants? I see Roland, I see Dr. Farrell.
Sorry, I just wanted to do a follow-up.
Yeah, Glenn, go ahead.
Hey, thank you very much. Thanks for that answer. I think it's really important to recognize that the markets that are receiving our gas are going to be more and more differentiating gas that comes from high emission sources and gas that comes from low emission sources. And when you pass through an energy facility, you automatically causing an issue with that. But that's just one issue. The in generating and producing gas, the emissions that come from that. I think what the world is putting pressure on these organizations in is the products themselves. So even if the product is delivered to the market in its cleanest form possible, people are concerned about the use of the products and the net zero ambitions that the companies have put out is not just in its own operations, but ensuring that the products that it sells to the market have net zero carbon associated with them. And what that means is in the oil and gas world, significantly reducing dependency on oil and moving gas toward clean gas, such as exporting and producing hydrogen and burying the carbon back then into the ground, for example, or creating what's called green hydrogen. So transitioning that, which needs to start taking place in a place like Trinidad and Tobago in the 2030s, requires some action now. And I guess the concern is we might climb out of this post-COVID crisis in oil and gas, but we're just running into another one. And if we don't start thinking about how to approach that now and what the opportunities for a country that has a lot of infrastructure already in place for things like ammonia and so forth, if we miss those opportunities, we really would miss a next potential wave of a new green energy economy for Trinidad.
Yeah. Gillian, you have a question? Why don't you go ahead and ask it?
Yeah, I'm glad that Glenn did a follow-up on that because I posted it in the chat before he came on, and I'll share it. TNT transitioning to a net zero carbon position requires a coordinated approach. It's across industry. Every area and aspect of business, it means us reviewing, rethinking, and re-engineering every aspect of the operations. Now, that understood, with Nigel knows where I'm going with this, with TNT's track record with collaboration and rethinking, I mean, Kevin made references to policies that date back as far as 1975 and before. Who's driving this? I fully agree with Glenn. If we're going to miss the boat. I mean, the world is collaborating more than it ever has as a result of COVID-19. Let's not waste this crisis. Who's driving it? Are there any major champions across industry that we're aware of who's standing out right now? Is there any hope in this regard that we are likely to see captains of enterprise and government working together for this transition? Nigel or Kevin?
I'll let Kevin go first.
I just want to be very, very honest as I could be. Mm-hmm. I think that as long as we have the electricity pricing where it is in Trinidad, there'll be little incentive for people to want to make that change. Mm-hmm. If I was to, and I'm not suggesting that we do this at all, because, you know, we're in a political season right now, right? I think somebody say Ramnara and say, right? But if you, we had a session at Lockjack some years ago, and one of the coordinators asked how much people want renewable energy in Trinidad, and everybody put up their hand. And then the guy, same guy asked how much people want to pay more for electricity, and everybody hand was down. So I think the first thing that we have to tackle is the whole issue of pricing of electricity in Trinidad. One of the things that has really propelled Jamaica in direction that Jillian, and Jamaica is a fantastic best case to me scenario. Jamaica is getting its electricity from LNG, from windmills, from solar, from some fuel oil, but it really diversified, and that's because the cost of electricity in Jamaica was really painful. And when people go to Barbados, they come back and they talk about the solar farm, and they come back and talk about solar water heaters, and that's because electricity derived from fossil fuel in Barbados is expensive and prohibitive. So you're not, to use a word, to borrow a word from Conrad and the ecosystem for what division that Jillian just typed up there is not yet here. So we have to get that ecosystem in place. One of the things that bothers me to no end is seeing a dump at the entrance of the capital city, right? And I mean, that is a perfect project there for waste to energy. And the Ministry of Energy had put out an RFP some years ago. Some of you may recall about 2 years ago, the ministry had an RFP for waste to energy. And I don't know where that ended up, but the dump itself in the Beetham landfill, I don't want to use the word dump, the Beetham landfill produces methane from the breakdown of the organic matter in the landfill. And that too could be used for power generation. We have no power plant in Trinidad, north of the Carony River again. And that is probably something which is a security concern. With the closure of Ryson Road, Power Gen Ryson Road, all our power plants are in central and south Trinidad, whereas your capital city is, of course, receiving power from so far away. So an ideal opportunity would be for a waste-to-energy power plant in Beetham that services Port of Spain and you know, places like the West and Diego Martin and so on. But those are all good ideas, but ideas in Trinidad take time. And I think to go back to that word ecosystem, the ecosystem is not there yet.
But I think ultimately the economics are going to drive.
Yeah, I agree.
So
yeah.
We have to begin weaning people off of cheap energy. And then getting the guys in the boardrooms and the strategic sessions to start adjusting and moving. And if that doesn't happen, I don't think you will get any action.
Yeah, we have to begin to wean people off this cheap electricity, which of course it lends to inefficiency. Somebody was, I think it was a gentleman named Christopher Narine Thomas, who worked at the Energy Chamber, had done a study on the use of electricity in the residential sector. It showed something like the majority of electricity is used by 15% of the households in Trinidad. The majority of the electricity consumed by residential customers is used by the top 15% income earners. So these would be people who have large houses, people who have, you know, your six-bedroom mansions and so on, and, you know, air condition running all night and so on. They pay the same light bill as a person who has a two-bedroom house, you know. So there is, as a result of that subsidy, there is a lot of waste. We've had the removal of the subsidy on liquid fuels. And you see that the removal of subsidy on liquid fuels has had some impact. You see more CNG cars on the road. Mm-hmm. I know it's not perfect. I know that we need a bigger CNG network. I think that is going to come with time. NGC CNG is going to be building a large CNG station on the highway at the entrance of Point Lisas on Rivulet Road. And you see more and more hybrid cars in Trinidad. So the removal of the subsidy on liquid fuels has changed some behavior.
Yeah. Two questions. One is from Joey Harinanan, and he said, is there a role for small business in this transition? I definitely think there is, and I think part of that role is doing commerce directly with the outside world on the e-commerce, that kind of platform. But what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think you know, for us to diversify, we really have to get the SME sector involved in services, but we have to focus on non-energy exports. In that, if you were to ask me, what is the most important thing Trinidad and Tobago has to do in the next 5 years? And I would say it is to earn foreign exchange by selling non-energy stuff to the world. So the question that it comes down to is that what can you produce that the world wants that you can produce competitively? All right? And if you eliminate from that answer LNG, crude oil, ammonia, and methanol, what are you left with? And that is the answer that we have to drive to. I was, if you go to Harrods and you go to the chocolate section in Harrods, there's Trinidad chocolate. And it's very proudly displayed as chocolate from Trinidad and Tobago. Pretty expensive, but I mean, it's Harrods, right? But those are some areas that we could explore for non-energy exports, right? And coming back again to the services sector, the same way Gillian spoke about a national coordinated effort for this energy transition, there has to be a national sort of strategic coordinated effort to develop that maritime services sector that I think is the big opportunity for Trinidad, that maritime services sector to service Guyana and Suriname.
Okay, thank you. And then Rawlin has, and I suppose this is the last one.
I think
some corporate governance is essential to survival of companies post-COVID, especially given what he says is the $40 billion estimated deficit over 2020 and 2021. I don't know whether the weak governance structures and practices in the state sector can be changed fast enough to face this challenge. What can we do to accelerate this transformation?
All right, well, if one of the things that happens is, see, when I give answers to questions like that, people always say, well, why didn't you do it when you were minister? Right? All right, okay, so I'm putting that out front immediately. Coming down to the end of my tenure as Minister of Energy, I had some conversations with McKinsey. Mm-hmm. About corporate governance in the state sector. And they brought some models to us, which I was very impressed with. One of which is how boards are constituted in the state sector has to change in Trinidad. It cannot be that all 7 or 9 directors are appointed solely by the cabinet. You have to have, now, the what was brought to me was, if you look at the Statoil model, and I think Statoil has now changed their name, right? Statoil is the Norwegian company, Statoil. If you look at Statoil's model, if you look at Saudi Aramco's model, you would see that they allow foreign directors on boards. Mm-hmm. They allow the union to appoint directors on boards. They allow the staff associations to appoint directors on boards. So what you end up with is a very diversified board that doesn't have all the directors coming from one source. And I think that is a good starting point for Trinidad and Tobago, that you have different directors coming from different sources, mm-hmm. as opposed to all the directors coming. I think that is going to be very positive for us. I don't know what your thoughts are on foreign directors. I think once they could add value, mm-hmm. Certainly, if you look at the board of Saudi Aramco, you would see a number of people who don't look like Saudi Arabians to me, right? A couple of them are on the board of that company. So those are some of the things that I would suggest. Changing how we appoint boards, I think, is important.
I think that's an interesting perspective, and I agree that once a direct, we need to be clear about what value we expect them to add, whether it's context in terms of access to market or expertise of some other expertise, but there must be some value add, whether they come from the from whether they're foreigners or whether they are appointed by the union. We have to be very clear that you're here to add value and to create sustainable growth for the company while ensuring that we develop Trinidad and Tobago. But so those will be some of my comments. So Kelvin, we are at 12:30, and I think I want to
About the late start. It was a bit of a misunderstanding on my part. And yeah. I had some construction going on here at home that so I had to like tell the fellas, you know, get a ladder out of my study, unplug your drill, right?
We're in the time of COVID. We all have to
I thought about that. I said, this is a COVID story here. This is the challenge of working from home.
No, exactly.
Because you have, you know, construction, people at home and so on. But,
yeah.
Wrap
it up with some words of wisdom. And again, I want to thank you for taking the time.
I will tell you something. I am an eternal optimist when it comes to Trinidad and Tobago. Trinidad and Tobago is not, we have the potential to re-engineer this economy. We've done it before.
Mm-hmm.
We did it after the 80s, after the crash of the economy in the 1980s. We went through a period of economic growth from the year 1993 all the way to the year 2008. We had 15 consecutive years of economic growth. And one economist actually pointed out to me that, interestingly, that happened right after the TNT dollar was floated, right? I think we have the opportunity to re-engineer the economy. Mm-hmm. If you look at every point in Trinidad's economy where there is dysfunction, it is because there is the absence of market forces.
Mm-hmm.
So wherever you have the absence of market forces and you have subsidies, or you have the government's footprint in the economy might become, there are certain things I think the government should not be involved in. And there are certain things I think the government should be involved in.
Mm-hmm.
But we have the opportunity, and this gives us an opportunity now to re-engineer the economy along the lines of efficiency and productivity
mm-hmm.
and diversification. And I think that, you know, if we don't grab that in the next couple of years, it probably is going to not present itself again.
Mm-hmm. Agreed. Thank you very much. Kamla, over to you.
Okay. Thank you very much, Nigel. And thank you so much, Kevin. That was really a very interesting presentation and discourse that you gave us. Just reminding persons that you would have received poll questions from Christy, which we'd appreciate if you fill out for us before leaving. Just to summarize quickly for someone like me who is not really at all, in fact, involved in the energy sector, what I'm hearing that Kevin has shared with us is that we should really expect that electricity prices may go up. We know that the oil and gas price will not recover, at least for another 3 years or so. And even with that, Trinidad and Tobago still appears to be in a bit of a better position than the rest of the Caribbean because of how devastated they have been with tourism coming to an absolute standstill. So we would, in fact, be having a discussion on the tourism sector. We expect to do that about 2 weeks from now. And of course, we have to look at the fact that there's that need for us to look at a green environment and reducing our carbon footprint. Therefore, it really appears to be a kind of perfect storm, as Dr. Farrell had described for us. So in truth, the crisis continues. I want to share then a phrase that our friend Jillian has been using for her sessions on a weekly basis, which is that in crisis, there's also opportunity. So we have to identify where the opportunities are. From what I've heard Kevin say, the good news appears to be that our financial sector appears to be stable. It means, therefore, that we should be able to go to our bankers. We should be able to come up with innovative ideas, new ways of doing things that we would be able to get financial support for in order for us to transform the way we do business. And I think this really is the challenge for our boards. Directors need to pay attention to the fact that the environment is changing. Sitting and waiting over the next few months is not going to bring any value, but rather to face what the reality is and find new ways. And I think we in the region, just as Kevin says, you know, we can be optimistic because we have faced hurdles in the past and we've been able to overcome them. I look forward to us being able to strengthen our governance practices so that we can help, in fact, ensure that as we move into the marketplace, and as Kevin says, you know, we should really ensure that the market forces drive our decision making. Let's ensure that we are able to come out of this because we are working with information, with data that supports how we steer our companies moving forward over the next few years. So thank you all very much for attending today's session. I hope you got as much value from it as I did. Just to remind you, we have Governance Week coming up at the end of this month, and we look forward to you continuing to participate in all of our sessions, seminars, and our conference. So thank you all very much. Next week, by the way, we'd be looking, those of you who are volunteer directors on nonprofit charitable boards, there is legislation which requires new conformance that is due at the end of this month. So next week, Thursday, we'd be looking at the Not-for-Profit Act and what those new obligations are for those of us who need to now comply. So thank you all and have a wonderful rest of the day.
Thank you. Take good care.
Okay. Thank you, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Yes. Thank you, Kevin.